Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to this lecture in the Senate Department's occasional lecture series. We are constantly being told that information technology has changed elections and changed politics and changed everything. But is it true? Today we have perhaps one of the best people to answer that question for us. Dr. Sally Young has made it her business to investigate this question, and she is going to answer it for us today. Please welcome her to the podium.
Thank you, Harry. You set a big task for me today to explain something that's puzzling academics and political scientists, commentators, journalists and politicians around the world about what is the true impact of new technology on politics. So, in putting together this paper, I was trying to think about what specific topic I was going to talk about today. A lot of interesting things happened during the 2007 federal election, for example. And at the same time I was thinking about what I wanted to focus on, I was also writing two academic papers. And the contrast between the two topics that I was working on struck me as saying something important about the changing nature of media and politics in Australia today. The first paper was about Sky News, and I don't know if any of you watched Sky News during the election last year, but Sky made a commitment to have what it called the most comprehensive coverage of an election ever, including breaking into programming to show in full and live press conferences and other media events that were going on during the campaign. There were hours and hours of content, including Sky News Active, a 24-hour channel devoted to the election. So in one sense, there was all this information, news about politics and elections, 24 hours a day worth of it, on a particular TV channel. On the other hand, I was investigating for a different academic paper what television news on commercial channels, as well as the ABC and SBS, is like in Australia. And I was looking at news clips during the election. And what I found was that the average news clip on a free-to-air television program is 2 minutes long, the ones on politics, even during an election campaign, just 2 minutes. And of that, politicians will only get to speak in 7-second sound bites, totalling up to about 30 seconds. The rest of the clips taken up with the reporter and the host, other media and expert figures talking. So that means that during an election, most people who are watching television, they're not watching Sky News, as I'll come to, they're watching free-to-air television stations and news, are getting only about 30 seconds of politicians talking per night and 2 minutes of election news. So how could I understand this contradiction between, on the one hand, being able to watch all this new content on politics, but on the other hand, the fact that not many people are watching it on Sky News, and that on the main channels where people are watching news, there isn't much of it at all on politics. So this led me to think about this contradiction, and it's what I want to talk about today in terms of the internet, because the internet as well is posited as something that can save democracy, that can open it up, increase political participation, and so on. But before I come to that, I need to talk a bit about, I think, the audience for political content in Australia. And an experienced political pollster estimated a few years ago that only about 10% of the population in Australia takes an active interest in politics. A lot of what we know about Australian attitudes to politics come from research performed at the Australian National University. And their studies have found that if you look at formal political participation, the indicators suggest that not many people are actively involved. Only about 4% of Australians belong to a political party, for example, compared to about 45% who belong to a sport or recreation group. Or another example, during an election campaign, usually only about 5% of people will attend any sort of political meeting, rally, and so on. And even though people tend to overestimate what we might think are good civic qualities, such as in, you know, interest in politics, when they're surveyed, 17% of people in Australia in 2007 admitted that they had not much or no interest in politics. And 12% said they wouldn't vote at all if it were voluntary. So this builds up this picture of the broad ends of this spectrum. About 5 to 10% of Australians who are very interested in politics versus the 12 to 17% that are so uninterested they freely admit it and might not vote at all if it wasn't for compulsory voting. Now, given that people are reluctant to acknowledge a lack of interest in politics when they're asked in a politics survey, that number might actually be larger. What we can say then is very broadly is that for every Australian who's highly engaged and interested in politics, there are at least two who aren't. So now that we have this very broad picture of these two different groups, what I'll call the dedicated seekers of political news and information versus the indifferent, we can consider where they get their political news and information via the media, if at all. So just as our interest in politics tends to divide us, so does our media use when it comes to getting information and news about politics. If we're interested, there are a host of options available, including the more traditional places such as the ABC, SBS, news and current affairs programs, broadsheet newspapers, public radio and so on. But the two major options that have opened up in Australia are pay TV and the internet. Now, I talked about pay TV before in terms of Sky News, and I think something very interesting is happening with Sky News. It's the only locally produced 24-hour news channel in Australia. But by international standards, the take-up of pay TV in Australia has been very slow. It's growing, but at 2005, only about 23% of households had it, compared to around 88% in the US and 50% in the UK. Even taking that into account, Sky News's viewing figures are small. As an overall percentage of TV viewing, at any one time, Sky News captures only 0.5% of the Australian TV viewing audience. So it's a fantastic resource for anyone who's interested in politics, but that's what and who it's for, news junkies and political junkies. It's not reaching that broader section of people who aren't interested in politics. Now let's look at the internet. And it's true that the amount and variety of information on the internet has dramatically increased over the past few years. And in order to illustrate this, in the written version of this paper, I've drawn a caricature of an extreme political junkie who goes online to get information news and all of the options that are available to that sort of person. They can listen to public radio through their PC, they can go on news websites, they can look at parliamentary inquiries that are going on through the APH website, they can go on email lists, they can download podcasts of news, they can email, they can blog, they can watch political clips on YouTube. They can read at places like Online Opinion, New Matilda, Australian Policy Online. They can go on Facebook and talk to other people who are interested in politics, and so on. There are a whole range of options. But that, of course, is not the average Australian. And my point in drawing out all the options that are available to them is to illustrate how, on the one hand, there are more and more of these types of options available for people who want political news. But on the other hand, these options on the internet particularly are for the deliberate, dedicated seeker of political information. You have to seek them out. They're unlikely to be options that you just come across when you're on the internet. And in terms of people who are using them, take-up rates in Australia are very low. And I'll talk a bit more about this in terms of a comparison with the US. But when people were asked back in 2003 what medium they used to get news and information in Australia, and this is just general news, it could be about entertainment, sport, the weather and so on, only 11% said they use the internet every day. And in 2008, an Australian Communications Media Authority report indicated that when Australians are on the internet, accessing news is fifth on the list of things they're doing. They're using email, they're banking, they're paying bills and so on, but getting news is lower down the list. In terms of politics and election news specifically, and this is where we come back to this division between the dedicated seekers and the others, the data from 2007 show that only about 5% of Australians used the internet during 2007 to get election news. It's very low. And that was a fairly generous estimation because that included people who used it only once or twice during the campaign. So despite all this focus on the internet, at this point in time, it's TV that's still by far the most popular medium, and it's the place where people are getting information, particularly when they're an accidental audience. So what we know about people is that most of them are not deliberately seeking out political news. When they asked people what kind of news they liked, political analysis was ranked last after other categories such as sports, entertainment and music. As I said, in my study of soundbites, I found that the more popular a TV channel is, the less election news stories it has on it, which explains why soundbites are so favoured by the commercial media in particular. So in terms of media use, people are voting with their feet, or their eyeballs in this case. They're going to different sorts of programs. The top rating programs on TV each year are sporting events and reality TV shows. The best-selling newspapers are not those with the weightier, longer sections on politics. It's the tabloids. And the same is true of online news. While there are mainstream newspapers online with their editions, it's places like 9MSN with its lighter approach to the news that's more visited. So the traditional media, I'm arguing, had places where people came across politics, even if they didn't deliberately go there to seek it out. People who thought they weren't particularly interested in politics but just wanted to get to the back section of the paper to read sports news might have seen a politics story on the front, stopped, read it, and on TV they might have been, again, waiting for the commercial news program to get to the weather or the sport news at the end of the program, but in between, if a politics news story was on, they would have seen it. And if they watched Current Affairs once upon a time, even on the commercial channels, there might have been politics stories or an interview with the Prime Minister or opposition leader. But now I'm arguing those accidental opportunities to come across politics are declining. TV news still has stories on politics, but less people watch it. There are shorter stories with politicians speaking less often. Current affairs programs on commercial television don't even pretend, I think, anymore to have politics on. For example, when he was hosting A Current Affair, Ray Martin declared that, quote, anyone who suggests that you get ratings by having the Prime Minister or Leader of the Opposition on is a dope. Australians don't want that. They don't watch. So on TV, we can see all these factors occurring, the absence of politics stories, declining emphasis on formal politics, shorter sound bites, and greater editorialism as more space is given to journalists and reporters and less to direct speech by politicians. In newspapers, similar things are happening. And if we look at online newspapers in particular, they're different on the internet than they are in hard copy. But hard copies as well are changing. And if we look at the most hit stories, so the ones that are most read on online newspapers, we see that it's the more tabloid-esque stories that attract more hits. So as a result, the options, I think, for accidental engagement with politics are declining, and it raises the spectre of these two groups having a division in terms of media use. They probably already do, but I think that the internet will compound this. So I'm arguing about this decline of accidentalism. And I'm wary of making extreme claims about the internet because I'm aware that we're in a transition phase, we're in an apprenticeship phase, really, about how to and what its potential and limitations are. I don't want to demonise it. I also don't want to downplay some of the significant things that are happening. But at the same time, I think we need to put it in a context, and these usage figures are an important part of that. What I'm arguing about with online newspapers is that they argue that they show very well this problem of declining accidentalism. And I might just put up the internet for a moment to show you what I mean. Now, if we go to Google and we go to news, and this is one of the sources that many young people are using for news rather than the mainstream traditional newspapers that have gone online, you'll see that it has this ability to customise, and so do other news websites. So you can actually click and edit what sort of news and information you're interested in, which raises the spectre of completely avoiding politics news if that's not something you think you're interested in. You can just have sports news. You can personalise it and customise it in all sorts of ways. And even if you don't do this yourself, we also have the possibility of websites doing it for you. And if you buy books from Amazon, for example, you'll notice that it personalises its suggestions for you. It knows you buy politics books or sports books, whatever it might be, and next time you go on there, it gives you recommendations. So they anticipate what they think you're interested in as well and change the content accordingly. Just another example, Yahoo News, which is another one that's quite popular. It's also the ability to sign up here and customise the news format. So what's happening here is that the accidental audience is not going to necessarily just come across politics news anymore. there's the possibility that when they log on, the stories that they see will be customised to preferences they've already indicated or that they've already shown through their usage. Okay, while I've got this up, I also want to show you another part of the online world that has been posited as a solution to this sort of democratic malaise. YouTube. There was a lot of talk during 2007 about that election being the internet election, and a lot of talk about YouTube in particular, that people were going there for political news and information. Both major parties had YouTube channels and put videos up. A lot of them were their own political ads that they were putting on television, but other people were putting clips up as well. And in the academic literature, quite a lot is made of this as an example of people engaging with politics. Whereas with television, you just sat there and the parties advertised at you, got their message across to you. With YouTube, you can take their ads, rip them off, and in terms of ripping the content off, controlling it, reworking it, hashing it, making fun of it, ridiculing it, and so on. So in some of the literature, quite a lot is made of this as an example of the internet's democratising potential. And just for a laugh, I thought I'd like to show you two YouTube clips that were quite popular during the 2007 election, at least online. But again, I want to stress in terms of context that the audiences for them were quite small. And because the ABC is recording this, I've got one anti-Labor one and one anti-Coalition one, just to be absolutely sure. Okay, this one was from someone who works in IT who said he was sick of television ads. He wanted to be able to talk back to them, so he made this clip that he posted on YouTube that I'll play for you. Stop it there because it's struggling to play it as well as it might. But as I said, for balance, I'll give exactly the same amount of time to the anti-Labor one.
我边防军北上部队濒临高平城下的时候，我驻靖西线的部队从另一个方向朝高平压过来。这时，高平的越军要想冲出我军的包围，只能向西南方向逃走。我边防军不顾山高路险，一路猛跑，在越军还未赶到纳龙之前。 越南反中国边境地段就达150余次，武装挑衅700余次，打死打伤，把高平以北以东的地区分割成几块，所以高平溃逃的越军都落入我军布下的天罗地网，逃不出覆灭的下场。武装挑衅700余次，打死打伤中国边境居民300余人。
Okay. All right, I'll stop that there and I'll turn that off. I know I'm not as entertaining, but it gives you a sense of why people think the internet might be so powerful, engaging people who aren't so interested in traditional political content. Some of these get more hits, particularly in the US when there are funny blogs. They get more hits than the official sort of news sources and the political ads the parties are putting out. But again, the audiences for them are still quite small, and especially in Australia. So I've shown you a bit about the internet, both its potential and its limitations. The examples that I showed you about Yahoo and Google and how you can personalise news, I think, is one of the worrying signs about how people could avoid politics news if they thought that it wasn't relevant to them. However, there are also these sorts of different presentations of politics that might appeal to some people who aren't interested in formal politics or the way it's traditionally presented. And fragmentation is compounding all of this as media audiences split up. Whereas once you had a mass audience watching something like Channel 9 News or Channel 7 News, because there weren't too many options, five channels, three commercial ones, and so on, now there are far more choices of news content, or so it seems. So just as a Victorian example, where once someone who was interested in sport might buy the Herald Sun or the Age, and as I said, go to the back to look at the sports section, perhaps on the way see there are political stories that might catch their eye, now they might just go straight to a sports website, a sports news site, and Yahoo has a sports news page, for example, the AFL website you could go to if that's what interested you, or ESPN, or other sports news-only sites. So there's this ability to choose particular media products. Now, part of the uncomfortable question in all of this is, should we just let them go? I mean, part of this is about choices. If people aren't interested in political news, then who am I to suggest that they should be? They could likewise say to me that I should read more sports news. In response, I'd suggest a couple of things. One is that I don't think people have been really given an adequate choice in the past. When I looked at the television news clips, for example, I found that they were overwhelmingly similar. The same sound bites, for example, on all five channels at once, same presentations of news, even in precisely the same order sometimes of events, very similar interpretations, lack of other voices, and so on. You could say all sorts of criticisms about TV news. Same sorts of criticisms you could apply to newspapers. So I think there's been a standardised format, there's been a commercialisation of news with ratings that have driven the programs in similar sorts of formats. There's been a lack of imagination, in other words, about how to change news formats and how to keep up with people who are more interested in different presentations of politics like those sort of clips. Now, I'm not suggesting that they play funny clips at the end of the news and so on, but I am saying that there hasn't been much thought, I don't think, about how news could be presented differently. And that has to do a lot, I think, with this standard formula. Now, as a sign as well about the potential for good political news and how it might attract people, I'd point to something which could be interpreted as a positive sign, if you're this way inclined, which is that the rise in audience share for the ABC and SBS has been an interesting phenomenon of late. That of all the TV stations, these are the ones that seem to be growing, while the other commercial channels are not. And I'll come back to that in a moment. But in terms of my argument about should we just let these people go if they're not interested in politics news, why should we funnel them into something they don't want? I'd suggest a proverb, although it sounds paternalistic, I think there's something in it. What interests people is not always good for them. What's good for people does not always interest them. Now, I know that's paternalistic, and I know I could be criticised for suggesting that people be more interested in politics news, but I think the opposite is a more dangerous thing. I think you don't do people who aren't interested in politics, the people who are disengaged, any favours by supporting their exclusion, even if they seem to choose it. And on balance, I think a democracy without politically aware citizens is a more dangerous thing. Now, if I was in a media studies or a cultural studies conference among academics who argue that Australian Idol and Big Brother are just the same and just as important as formal politics, I'd have to justify and explain that argument a whole lot more. But I think, given the audience and where we are, that I'm safe to assume that I'm among people who believe participating in and knowing about formal politics is important. So I'll move on. Now I want to come to these scenarios about this decline of accidentalism. A couple of signs of concern, firstly, before we get to some signs of hope. And again, as I stress, I know we're in a transition phase and some of these signs can be read either way, and I'll point to some of those problems. But if we take as our starting point that printed newspapers have been a bedrock of political news, whereas the shape of online news is far more ambiguous, and I could have put up some of the, you know, broadsheet newspapers online websites, I think would make this point. If you look at how they're presented online, the news there, and what people are looking at, I think we see that they're quite different, as I said. But if we look at the printed hard copies, which, as I say, have been this bedrock of political news, we see that the Australian Press Council reported in 2006 that nearly half of those who read metropolitan newspapers are over 50, which doesn't bode well for the future. Nearly 70% of their readers are now aged over 35. And in the 4 years between 2000 and 2004, the biggest decline in their audience was in the 18 to 24-year-old group. But they have broader problems. Although people are moving to online news, and we can posit that young people will increasingly go to the online version rather than buy the hard copy, which is what I myself do, which doesn't help their circulations any, they are struggling to find a business model that they can make work online. The traditional revenue that's underpinned their journalism, the quality journalism we might call it, is declining. The classifieds, for example, that used to be their rivers of gold as an income stream, people are instead using eBay and online places to sell and trade. So they're struggling as well to get us to look at ads online. And they're giving us the content for free, which is something they can't really necessarily go back once they've gone that model. So they have to find a way to make income from this, to pay for the quality journalism that they had, to pay for investigative reporters and so on. And that's a challenge. The Economist argued in 2006 that newspapers are, quote, on the way out, and that half the world's newspapers are likely to close in the foreseeable future. Let's turn to television for a moment, because when people get political news, especially that accidental audience, TV is where they get it. Free-to-air TV is struggling as well. Ratings and audience share are declining, and as we've said, those programs devote very little time to politics anyway. But again, their problem is a younger audience. Despite moral panics about young people watching too much TV, it's adults over 55 who watch the most. They average 4 hours and 17 minutes of viewing per day, while young adults are now the lightest users, averaging under 2.5 hours a day. So in other words, you could suggest, and some have, that newspapers and television are old people's media now. Young people are moving to other things, cinema, music, magazines, the internet, of course, video games, places that don't necessarily emphasise formal politics. They're turning away as well from TV news and current affairs and that format, describing it as boring, complex, unrelated to their own lives and so on. And much has been made about how this might be because they're very media savvy, they've studied things like Frontline, they know how patronising and sensational and unethical and nonsensical some commercial current affairs program content is. And while those programs have taken politicians off, it hasn't necessarily saved them. Current Affair, for example, averaged its lowest audience for this decade in 2007. So this is one of the trends that I'm not sure how to read, because on one hand, I'm tempted to say that commercial news and current affairs programs are so bad that it's a good thing they're dying. And optimistically, it might herald a new dawn, a new era where these television stations have to do some kind of new programming to engage people. So I don't know, as I said, how to interpret that exactly, but on balance I'll choose to be optimistic and see it as a sign of hope that even those tired formats are going. Now, as I said, the ABC, if we look at that, it's increased its audience share. For example, in 1983, 11.9% was its audience share. In 2007, it's 16.7%. So it's growing, and so is SBS, whereas the other channels are not doing so well. Now, is that because people are choosing the better political content in terms of what's on the ABC or SBS? Or is it because, again, the ABC is an old person's place and that audience lends itself to watching ABC News and current affairs? So, again, not one that I'm not sure how to interpret, but I'll, again, choose to optimistically interpret it as a sign that if you present good news and current affairs programs, if you do present political content, people will watch. Now, I've focused on news and journalism so far, but I haven't mentioned yet one of the main ways that people accidentally come across politics, and that is through the political party's advertisements. You might be watching Big Brother or Australian Idol or some other program and an ad comes on. That's one way now that you'll accidentally come across the content if you don't buy newspapers or if you only go to one of those sites where you can personalise the content and skip politics news. We're also seeing the parties use direct mail letters, telephone voice recorded messages, emails and SMS, and they'll use them more in the future. Now, if political content in journalism, in media programs and media outlets declines, those methods are going to become more central, and that's where people will get a lot of their political information from. I put that under the sign of, or under the category of a worrying sign. We can talk about that. Now, some signs of hope. Let's think about the changing media landscape. I said that in Australia we're not really using the internet for political information yet, but if we look at the US, we can see where we might end up. Now, there are a lot of different factors in terms of political culture, internet and broadband cost and speed. There are all sorts of things involved here. But it's interesting, I think, that in 2008, and it was an interesting primary campaign, there's no doubt about it, but 40% of Americans were using the internet to get political news. That's compared to the less than 5% here during the last election. And that grew rapidly. In 2000 in the US, only 16% of adults were using it to get political news. Now it's up to 40%. You'll notice we're not even where the Americans were in 2000. So there's a long way to go. But the trends there suggest that this is where we will head. Television audiences will decline, the internet will go up. We see that in the 18 to 29-year-old category for election news, this is what's happening. So clearly the internet's going to play a central role. But in terms of what we've looked at, is it going to capture this accidental political audience or is it going to push them further away from politics? Now, if we believe that political news can be interesting, then I think there are hopeful indicators. Because in amongst those 40% of people in the US who use the internet to get election news, a lot of them said they just came across the news and information when they were going online to do something else. They weren't seeking it out. So there is an element of accidental happening upon news, and that's promising. Where this was occurring was because political information was being spread via social networks, online social networks, sites like MySpace and Facebook. Now, social networking sites are one of these phenomena that we still don't know what to make of them, same as we are still confused about the impact and power of blogs. They could go either way. These could be just a flash in the pan or a long-term trend. But if Rupert Murdoch's bought one of them, then he seems to think that there's something in it. And usually he has some sense of the play of media trends. So at the moment, this is playing an important role for young Americans in getting political news. Now, how does this work? For example, the Hillary Clinton campaign wanted to go and visit a university campus, so they contacted the president of the local Hillary Club on that campus. She sent a message to her friends, an invitation to attend this rally, and within 24 hours, she estimates that message spread from friend to friend online so that 800 people had seen it just in a matter of one day, and 400 people showed up for the meeting. So there are some specific examples of how this is being used to mobilise political audiences. In Australia in 2007, the ALP claimed to have some success with its MySpace profile for Kevin Rudd with 117,000 visitors. But unfortunately, we don't have that element of public meeting and using it to engage people in a physical sense. Nevertheless, these are all signs of what might occur. Interestingly, one of the other major sources for politics and election news in the US for young people is comedy shows, shows like The Daily Show. And surveys found that people who watched those shows were just as well informed as the audiences of elite news sources like broadsheet newspapers. And it largely seemed to be because a lot of them were heavy news viewers anyway. But similarly, researchers also found that similarly, breakfast and light entertainment programs, as well as those comedy shows, can reach a wider audience, people who don't necessarily turn on for political news. Now, I focused on TV and newspapers, but the same could also be said of radios, for example, when politicians go on programs that don't normally have political content, like FM radio. And there are also signs, or positive signs, in terms of pay TV. Young people do seem to turn on pay TV channels in the US, particularly when events or crises occur that they want to watch happen in real time, so they're interested in the breaking news. In Australia, again, we're a bit different. Pay TV is very expensive compared to overseas, so that probably negates the possibility of it becoming a very widely used, broadly available medium, especially to that accidental audience in the near future. So some of these signs, I think, are positive. Some of them are worrying. As I said at the start, I don't want to romanticise the past or say that everything is changing, that the internet is either fantastic and will mobilise people or, on the opposite hand, will isolate and alienate people. It's probably going to be, like most things, a bit of both. And I don't want to romanticise the past either. Just because newspapers used to print long transcripts of parliamentary speeches doesn't mean that everyone read them. Just because there were public meetings and lunchtime rallies and other things doesn't mean everyone went to them. Then, as now, there were people who were highly engaged. There were people who attended meetings, read widely, and so on. And there were also the less interested, people who shied away from formal politics. But what I am suggesting, though, is that those non-interested people, if they did interact with media, if they read a newspaper or listened to the radio or watched TV, they were more likely then, as opposed to now, to happen across political content, even if they didn't go looking for it. And there are a range of factors for this, but one of the key ones, I think, was an underlying belief among media proprietors and journalists that politics was of general interest to citizens. And if it wasn't of interest to them, that it should be. Now that attitude might be seen as paternalistic, telling people what's good for them. But I think it's also extremely important, and it's socially beneficial, that it's well-intentioned often, that it has an aim of including people who might otherwise be left out. So while the internet is giving us a range of materials to address this, we can go on websites, we can go on YouTube and watch videos like the ones I've shown, we can look at blogs, we can get podcasts. We know that not all Australians are using them. Very few are using the internet for political content. And I think this is important to remember in terms of how TV was talked about when it came in. People at the time did the same sort of thing. Some were arguing that it would revolutionise politics, open it up. Others argued that it would be more of the same. And I think what we've learned from television, especially when we look at commercial television, is that having more or better tools, as in the medium, to engage in politics doesn't automatically mean that those tools will be used. Existing actors, structures, systems, and people's preferences still play a key role. So as I said, trying to get behind all the hype and demonisation of this new medium, I think it's likely that the internet will be both helpful in transmitting political news, as well as a place where there will still be great divisions between us in terms of how we think about politics, whether we're interested, and how we get our news. And in this context, while there's been a lot of focus on the quality of news media lately, what I'm suggesting is that opportunity now seems just as important. And providing outlets for the interested is comparatively easy. There are a host of options online, and those are growing. But reaching and engaging that uninterested audience is far more challenging. Somehow, we need to have a degree of happenstance about political news and information so that people come across it in their day-to-day lives and see it as relevant and interesting. Given what we know about media audiences and political interest, this may demand a different approach, I think, than conventional journalism has traditionally provided. Thank you.
Good. Thank you very much. We have some time for some questions. Could I ask any questions to go to the microphones? Well, could you go to the microphone? Now, the gentleman at the microphone has my permission to ask a question, brief and concise.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First of all, I'd like to thank a very interesting talk, plus the use of that background. Often we don't get that, and I find I'm a visual person. I would like to just make an observation before I get to my question. Would you please take a look at your audience? Everybody, take a look at yourselves. Where is the youthful mind that wants to know? We've got them. Got them. Now, will the other audiences that are older indicate that you're present? And when you do this, this is what I'm trying to, the point I'm making. We are getting older and the great baby boomers are joining us. And we are the voting majority. That's my point. The second thing is I thought I'd test myself as a preliminary.
What about
I've
this question?
Turned off the radio for 30 years. And why have I turned off? I refuse to be barged at by anybody. Now, here's my question.
Right.
My question is, we are all in a mental ditch. And as soon as you realise that, you say, well, what are my alternatives to getting out of a mental ditch that somebody else has put me in? So my question to you simply, what mental ditch would you put all of us in? And using that as your base, what did you leave out of your lecture?
Well, do you want to respond?
Let me just say that's one of the more interesting questions I've ever had. I think it was, what sort of ditch are we in? I don't want to presume that anyone in this room is in a ditch. And in terms of the presentation, even when I was dividing people into the interested and the not so interested, I don't want to presume that just because they're interested in formal politics, that they wouldn't be if it was presented in a different, more interesting way. So I'm not sure that we're in a ditch at all necessarily, especially as individuals. What I am concerned about is the media landscape and the way that it's changing, and the way that particularly it presents political news or doesn't. I don't know if that's a good answer to a question, but a thought-provoking statement nonetheless.
Yes.
I should explain before I make this comment that I'm a mongrel. I'm half French and half English. And because of that, I am able to compare the way television news is broadcast in France and in Australia. I watch the television news every morning, French television news, on SBS. I lived before that 20 years in France, so I was watching it regularly. Now, one thing I notice in France is that politics is made more interesting in the news, by television news, by the quality of the presenter. The presenter in Australia, I'm afraid to say, is just that, a presenter. In France, the presenter has to be able to interrogate, rather in the style of Kerry O'Brien, shall we say. And this makes the political section of the French news far more interesting. People are always waiting to see politicians of any party being tripped up by a good interrogator. Isn't it a pity that this isn't the case in Australia?
And I think partly that has to do with the limitations of the format, as I said. I mean, 2 minutes of election news is not much time to analyse or pick apart or interview people. I think there are a great many problems with the way news is presented in Australia. But thank you. And I think the international comparison is very interesting because if you look overseas, there are examples of how this is done better and differently.
Yes, the lady over here.
I just had two things to say. The first is a kind of observation, just a reflection on your point about ABC and SBS attracting more audiences. And I wonder partly whether it has something to do with the fact those two broadcasters seem to have a slightly more global flavour to them. They're not as parochial in some ways as some commercial channels. So maybe, you know, younger people have a sense of belonging to a more sort of dispersed community. Maybe that appeals to them more, I don't know. But the question I did have was, I don't know whether there are examples in Australia, but certainly overseas, and one example of this would be the Telegraph in the UK, where there's a sense of converging media platforms where radio and broadsheets are increasingly going online, but not just providing written words, but they're actually having sort of short presentations from their own journalists. And so there is actually a complete changing of the platforms on which media are presented. So the way that you will come across things is changing. It's not just going to be statically reading an article and pulling it up. You'll come across clips that you didn't intend to come across.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. And in terms of convergence, and they also call it intermediation about how things are merging. And I know in Australia and our online newspapers, there are already examples of that. You know, sometimes during the election, reporters will do blogs or they'll post clips on the websites and so on. So, yeah, the format of news is changing. But I still think that you have to go to those sites to get that. So you have to think in the morning when you get up, OK, I want to read a paper today, whether it's online or not. And when I go there, if there's a clip about the election, I'll watch it. So it needs to, I think, as I say, have a degree of seeking that information out, which is... And in some sense, that was always the case. You always had to go and buy a hard copy of a newspaper. And the format is definitely changing, but perhaps that more visual presentation online will be more popular, or perhaps it will come across the same sorts of problems that exist on television as well. But the one thing I can say as a positive sign about that is that with the lack of advertising interspersed between, as you have at the moment with news, creates more space and probably creates the potential to have a different kind of news as well. But thank you. That's an interesting point.
Dr. Young, looking at that small percentage who are very interested in politics, have you been able to find out whether they search the media, they follow politics on the media to reinforce their views, their own beliefs in politics or partisan support, or are they looking for a challenge to their views? Are they open-minded? What is the purpose of people who are that small percentage in going through the news?
Yeah, again, an interesting question. Not a lot of specific research has been done that I know, but if we look at, say, the demise of the Bulletin, for example, I mean, commercially, these people aren't necessarily enough to keep even that afloat if that's what the proprietor's aim is. But in terms of whether they use it to reinforce their own political views or challenge them, you know, the general view would be that people like to read news that agrees with what they're already thinking and doesn't particularly challenge them. But then again, I guess that people who are really interested in politics do seek out different viewpoints. And, for example, I know a lot of academics might read polemical sort of columnists that they don't necessarily agree with, but they want to see what they're saying and what sort of agendas are coming up in those columns. So, you know, that's academics who are particularly interested in left politics, for example, and obviously the same thing happens on the other side. But my short answer, I suppose, should be that we don't know enough about what sort of media they're using. The people that would know are the media organisations. They must have this sort of research. One study that was done recently looking at terms of preferences was a Roy Morgan survey, and it found, for example, that Labor supporters watch the ABC more, whereas Coalition supporters watch Channel 9 more, that they had particular programs that they preferred. So there were some divisions. That's the only one I've seen, and it was a short survey.
Dr. Young, I'm interested in your opinion on onlineopinion.com and Crikey and New Matilda. As blog sites, the democratisation of opinion, if you think about what Chomsky said, who gets to say, who gets to know, who gets to decide, that's, I think, one of the growth areas that you sort of alluded to, but I just wanted to know if you think that's the difference between the US and the Australian populations and why there is a difference.
Yeah, it's hard to know precisely. I mean, there's a different sort of political climate, there's a different political system, there are technological factors going on. In terms of the sites that you're mentioning, I mean, I think these are all great things. That the more discussion we have, the more different sorts of sites, the more political blogs and so on, the better. And the more we have and the more diverse they are, the more chance that people will go to them and seek them out. My worry in this presentation, as I said, was the people who aren't interested already and they're harder to capture. But that doesn't negate the fact that I think some of these sites are doing incredibly good things and providing really interesting alternatives to that traditional media format and presentation of politics. Why Australians don't go to them more is an interesting question. Some of the bloggers have posited that the media in Australia being so heavily concentrated in terms of ownership has sort of killed the blogosphere. Blogs are far more vibrant and do more interesting things in the US. Sometimes they break news, for example, and so on, and we haven't seen a lot of that here in Australia. Some of their individuals are better resourced to do that sort of thing. But one blogger was suggesting that the mainstream media sites are linking to things like YouTube because they see that as a more controllable space. To get people to watch a clip like the ones we were watching is very much part of the soundbite culture. Directing them to really detailed political blogs it might be something quite different. And one blogger suggested that the mainstream media, because they see blogs as a threat, has co-opted them. So it's cherry-picked some of the bloggers and put them in their own organisations, or it's sort of linked to some of them but not others. And so I'm not sure, but some of the bloggers think that there might be an element of, you know, mainstream media in Australia not doing them any favours.
Now, I'm going to people in the order that they jumped, so the gentleman over here, can we keep the questions brief
to fit them in? Thanks for a good talk there, Dr. Young. I was just wondering if your studies factored in the sort of accidental peer-to-peer exposure of news reports that goes on online, specifically in sort of comments pages, forums, you know, messenger service. Young people are very good at informing each other. And you can often find issues blow up very quickly in these on these types of websites, even when they're not particular, say a gaming forum discussing censorship, for instance. So you do see a lot of politics out there, and I was wondering whether that had been factored into the stuff you'd been looking at.
Yeah, and that's sort of in the realm of those positive signs of hope that we were talking about, that part of the way this is going on is peer-to-peer and social networking conversations, and family and friend groups are very important, particularly to young people. Political news, women often nominate that as a place where they get political news and information from people they're talking to. And when that's going on online, it's replicating that same sort of thing as well. So I think that is all important and valuable. Academics argue a lot amongst themselves about what is politics. You know, if you count talking about Big Brother and who exited from the house and whether that was rigged or not, for example, could be called politics, whereas other people say it's only formal politics, you know, to do with policies and parties and parliament and so on. Now, I think those are interesting viewpoints. And in terms of what young people are talking about, a lot of the time they are talking about issues rather than perhaps, you know, what their local MPs just voted on or what new policy has come out, perhaps. You know, whether you judge that to be in the same category. I mean, I think it's all important, and conversations are an important way this is going to lend itself. And perhaps, as we said, that's one of the best signs of hope for the internet, this social networking, supposedly called Web 2. What we've seen so far is a very static internet hasn't allowed us to really do the things that, you know, we, you know, predicted would help democratise politics, whereas a Web 2 that's more interactive might allow more for this to occur.
Now, question from over the side.
My question really follows on from the last point. If we're looking at America versus Australia, certainly the primary elections did seem to engage in politics a lot of people who normally hadn't been engaged in politics. In some sense, the Obama campaign was predicated on this, and certainly used the internet, especially social networking, very much to achieve that. But it seems to me that this relates very much to the American political system, which is much more open in terms of individual candidates and individual candidates being able to reach voters than occurs here. So I guess my question is, would we expect to see this type of internet involvement in politics in Australia be directed at formal politics, particularly the major parties, or would we expect it to result in a much greater involvement in, I suppose, protest groups, interest groups, environmental groups, all the rest of it, noting the rapid spread of GetUp and that type of internet? In other words, I'm suggesting that maybe in Australia formal politics is not where we'll see the internet's political impact, but rather through a much greater range of activities.
That's what a lot of the research suggests as well about the political parties in Australia and how they've used the internet. There's been a lot of criticism that they haven't used it in a way that opens politics up. And as we were saying with the example I used about Hillary Clinton, I mean, they have primaries that stretch out for a long period of time. The candidates can go and sit in a coffee shop one day with three people, the next day they can address a rally of 75,000. There's a level of interactivity and excitement that goes on around that, whereas in Australia, you know, politics is presented quite differently. And perhaps, and this is, I think, the worrying thing, the internet will mirror that, that there'll be a lack of interactivity online, just as there is in real life. And maybe that's why we're not seeing such a high take-up in Australia for these sort of structural factors that you've pointed to. In terms of formal politics, people think that, you know, the internet's not a place to go, and that's why it hasn't been used in that way. But I think you raised some good points, and the political system and the attitudes around it and the way it currently works is important in how it's going to be used online as well.
One last question.
Dr. Young, would you comment on the introduction of editorial content into direct news broadcasts? The sort of thing I have in mind is that, for example, when referring to comments by a premier who's under criticism, they'll describe him as the embattled premier. Or when referring, for example, to the shadow treasurer, they'll also refer to him as the leadership contender, an editorial content in a direct news broadcast. Would you comment on that?
And that's an example of how you can see something as both a positive trend or a negative trend at the same time, because on the one hand, people might say, but those sorts of pointing out the conflict involved and the background and making it more interesting using language that opens it up is an example of how the news can be accessible. But someone else might point to that and say, that's an example of the media not being objective and presenting politics in a superficial sort of gladiatorial contest way. So it's a very interesting example of how you can look at the one thing and come up with two different takes on it. What I can say is that the research that I'm looking at in terms of comparing American news and Australian news found that this is likely to be where we will head, that there will be more editorialism. When I looked at their news clips, their reporters talked for longer. They had more experts and talking heads and commentators on, even on their news programs, let alone current affairs. So the media seems to think that politicians are a turn-off, that if you get, you know, reporters and commentators and so on talking, that would draw in an audience. That seems to be a perception that underlies that changing format. So I think we're actually going to see more of that in Australia as well.
I don't often do this, but can I interpose a very quick question? We haven't talked about the alleged dumbing down effect of the new media. Politicians, it's been argued, now can't present subtle, nuanced arguments because they'll be accused of not knowing where they stand and flip-flopping and so on. What do you think of that?
Yeah, I'd probably sidestep the whole question of dumbing down, because it's that question of quality news. You know, if you want people to engage with politics, are you going to also demand that they only consult the sources you think are good, you know, that they're going to go to those ones we call quality news sources? In terms of the dumbing down, I mean, what can you say in 2 minutes? What can you say in 30 seconds on a news clip? I mean, that's basically it. You know, if 80% are using television to get their election news and what they're seeing is that, a two-minute clip with 30 seconds of politicians talking broken down into seven-second soundbites, I mean, it is going to be a dumbed-down version of something. You can't present a lot of material in that time. Now, is that better than nothing, though? I mean, I think that's the question we're facing with the internet and what I was talking about with the accidental audience. Would we rather people just get that 2 minutes? Because in the future, they might be able to skip that altogether. They might be able to program your TV, just give me the sports news, or I'm only going to turn on to this channel and it doesn't have any politics on it. I don't like politics. So in a way, I used to worry a lot about declining standards in the media and how politics was presented, but I'm starting to get to a point where I think even dumbed-down stuff is better than nothing at all.
Right, thank you.
If that's the choice.
Please join me in thanking our lecturer. Well, that was very good.